Hey, this is Danko Jones, and you are listening to one of my favorite podcasts on the internet in the world, Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer.
Oh, well, that is sweet. Bless your heart, Danko Jones. Hey, everyone, it's Nate, host of the Vinyl Guide. Thanks for tuning in this week. As you've heard on the show today, the amazing Danko Jones, the man who fronts the band with his same name, yet it's a group and a goddamn good one at that. Danko has lots of hilarious stories. He's a very funny dude. He's been around the world a zillion times. He's even got his own podcast with an audience that's almost as handsome as mine. And you could hear more Danko up there or even check out his new book, I've Got Something to Say, available at Amazon.com or at Danko Jones Shows or wherever fine books are sold or stolen. Now, Danko Jones has a new LP, A Rock Supreme, which is coming out April 26th, but pre-orders are up now and special limited vinyl pressings are available. Order yours at DankoJones.com. In case you're just coming up to speed on Danko Jones, I'll play a few tracks today on the show. I wanted to give you guys the jump on these special vinyl packs before they sell out. So again, grab yours at DankoJones.com. And I want to quickly thank everyone for the amazing feedback on last week's episode featuring Jello Biafra, talking record collecting, music tastes, and of course everything in between in Jello's particular style. If you haven't heard our conversation with Jello yet, it's last week, episode number 160 of the Vinyl Guide. And if you like that, make sure to check out some other past episodes, including Henry Rollins, episode number 100, Miles Kennedy, episode number 128, Billy Howerdell of A Perfect Circle, episode number 122, Zach Wilde, episode 114, and of course, heaps more episodes and interviews at thevinylguide.com. And if you're a fan of Danko Jones and have vinyl copies of Wildcat, Fire Music, or even way back a 2002 pressing of Born a Lion, it is scientifically proven that those records will sound better if they are clean and free of dust and debris. Enter the Groove Washer Record Cleaner. The Groove Washer Record Cleaner fluid gets deep into the grooves and lifts out the dust, debris, and all that crap, allowing your stylus to travel easier through the groove and pick up more audio detail along the way. Groove Washer Record Cleaning kits start at less than $20, but I reckon you should get one of the deluxe ones, especially since I'm about to give you 10% off any purchase at groovewasher.com. Anything you buy at groovewasher.com is 10% off with promo code VINYLGUIDE10. So, what are you waiting for? Get a Groove Washer and hear the full Danko. 10% off with promo code VINYLGUIDE10 at groovewasher.com. Do it now. Okie dokie, I'm about to start the Danko interview immediately after this track from the new Danko Jones LP, A Rock Supreme, which can be pre-ordered at DankoJones.com. Here's the track, Burn in Hell.
Just behind the black line, wheels keep on turning as I drive down the hill. I don't mind my baby with me. Say hi to the devil and ring the bell. Scared of nothing anymore. They think they got me, but surprise, surprise, gonna knock them out so I can even the score. Wheels keep on turning as I drive down the hill. I don't mind my baby with me. Say hi to the devil and ring the bell. Gonna burn in hell. Gonna burn in hell. Gonna burn in hell. In hell. Hitting and I'm missing and I'm rolling and I'm teasing and I'm pinning. What y'all want by the way you wanna please them? I don't give a shit. I paid my dues, I lick them. If I need to, I can take them on and punch them back and still be there to grease them. If you wanna, I can drive straight to hell, cause I'm headed down there, already don't care. Looks on fire with the flames getting high, but it feels so good on a Saturday night. You think you're tough like a demon, but you really look scared. People picking up what's already out there. Don't blink, don't think, if you do, you're gonna sink. I can see it on your face, and I think it's only fair. Only hit back when facts start to smell. I think I know where we're going, and I ain't gonna tell. I can see you really wanna, do you wanna, do you wanna just sit right back and ring the bell? Wheels keep on turning as I drive. The devil and ring the bell. It's you and me, we're gonna burn in hell. Gonna burn in hell. Gonna burn in hell. Gonna burn in hell. In hell. In hell.
This week on The Vinyl Guide, we have on the show the phenomenal Danko Jones, whose new LP, A Rock Supreme, is dropping April 26th. However, pre-orders are available at DankoJones.com. Danko, how you doing today?
I'm doing good, Nate. It's fun to talk to you.
I've been so looking forward to this. I'm glad we were able to figure out a time. So you are in Eastern Canada, if I'm not mistaken, yeah?
I'm in Toronto, yeah.
Okay, so I'm probably the most opposite point on earth from you right now.
Yes.
In Australia. Yes. And when we were setting up this interview, rather than saying Toronto time, it was YYZ time. And of course, only musicians would really truly get that.
Yes, when you messaged me that, I said, ah, yes, he understands.
Yeah, either musicians or airline pilots. So my first question, Danko, is that a nickname? Is that your government name?
That's my government name.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
And it's kind of like at the time when we started our band, we were, in the garage punk scene, and every band wherever we looked was called the something, the Dirt Bombs, the Blues Explosion, the Oblivions, the Makers. And so, just to distinguish ourselves from it, I asked the guys to be in the band. I had just come out of my own other garage band, the Violent Brothers. So to change it up, I just said, hey, how about I just make it about me? Mm-hmm. And then 23 years later, it's
still about
stuck.
You.
Yeah. I mean, that seems kind of, I don't know if there's that many bands with the, as much as there was when, we started in 96, but
right.
Yeah.
But the band is called Danko Jones, but it's not all about you really. I mean, you've been in a solid partnership with JC for years and years, really since the beginning. Yeah.
Yes. Since day one, I asked JC to play with me when I found out his band had broken up and my band was about to break up. And it's just been a partnership since then. We've been through many drummers, but now we've had Rich Knox in the band for the last 6 years. And between the three of us, it's the most harmonious, and we're having a great time laughing through tours and having a great fun time making albums as well. Just wish, we found Rich a few years earlier, but that's how it goes. But yes, it's been JC and I since day one, and we've had a solid partnership, and we know, we have our designated jurisdictions. It works well. And I think we've been able to stay together for 23 years because we've avoided the pitfalls of other bands. And despite the band having my name on the marquee, behind the scenes, it is a democracy. It is equal say. It is three voices. And everybody knows that. And so, what you need to do in order to keep a band together is keep your ego in check. And we figured that a few years back.
Okay, yeah, because it must be a little bit odd just from JC to be such an equal partner, to be there really from the beginning, but you're the guy whose name is on the marquee, you're the guy who's probably front and center in all the different interviews. Were there any tense moments around that helped you learn those lessons?
Well, if there were, it wasn't really spoken of, and I've always made sure to let him know and to let, you know, whoever else is in the band know, Rich Knox, know that, look, I'm not asking for special treatment. I'm not asking to be, you know, I'm not, even though it's on the marquee, and, you know, we're all equal in this, and we're all gonna, you know, suffer or enjoy together. Mm-hmm. And hopefully just them knowing that is enough for them to, you know, keep on keeping on, and it's worked. You know, there's times where people assume I'm taking care of everything and I'm the guy that needs to make the final decision. They come to me first. But if they stick around, they'll quickly realize that they got to go through JC.
Okay. All right. So, Danko, let's start at the beginning. As a kid, you were born, raised Eastern Canada, Toronto, if I'm correct, or outside?
Yeah, I'm born and raised in Toronto, yes.
Okay. And what was the music scene like in Toronto? And I guess when you were a kid, I don't mean the live music scene, but I mean records and shops and being able to obtain music. What was that like?
When I started to be able to, you know, save allowance for, you know, 3-4 weeks to get an album, it was used record stores would allow me to buy for $10. I could walk out of there with 2 albums, 3 albums. Mm-hmm. So I was there was quite a few used record stores in Toronto growing up as a teenager, and you just always hit them. Mm-hmm. And whenever you know, I would save enough money, and cassettes were a great way to get more albums. You would dub a cassette, or you would record an album on a cassette, and it would double, triple your listening experience. And that's pretty much how I grew up. And then I didn't have a proper stereo. I would often use my Walkman with speakers. And so I grew up listening to music on terrible stereo equipment. So my ears aren't really attuned to a lot of what vinyl, you know, collectors are. They want the best needle, they want the best system, they want the best speakers. I just want to hear the music. I'm so used to listening to music through crap headphones and crap speakers that it just really, I was able to just zero in on what sounds good through the garbage speakers, you know. That's been my experience.
So was music kind of the center of your life, or did you also do BMXs and whatever habits you had as a kid, or was music pretty quickly the center of your focus?
Yeah. I mean, when I was, you know, in grade school, I loved baseball and I loved comic books, but if the talk turned to music, I mean, Kiss was the number one band for me when I was 6 years old. My mom finally relented after me bugging her, and we walked into Music World at Fairview Mall in Toronto, and she said, you can pick one album. And so I picked Kiss Alive because it seemed like the thickest album. It was a double album.
It was a quantity decision. Yeah.
Yes, with a booklet inside. And so I thought I'd get more bang for my buck. There was an address to the Kiss Army on the back. If you look at old covers of it, you will see that address I wrote to. And I cannot remember in my mind's eye how long it took, but I got a response from Kiss. And I joined the Army. And I got some 8x10 glossies. I got a couple of school folders. And that made me a fan for life.
Let me ask you this. Do you remember when Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park was shown on TV?
I do remember. I had just been taken to see The Nutcracker. And I was, I totally remember it. And I watched about half of it as it aired on television. And I remember the scene where Gene Simmons destroys the evil Gene, or the robot Gene, destroys the park at night. Mm-hmm. I remember that very, very well in my head. And then year, a few years later, it aired on TV late at night, and I got I was in high school. I used the VCR, the family VCR, to record it, and I've seen Phantom of the Park now close to 100 times, maybe.
Wow. Okay. I haven't been able to get to the second viewing. Okay. All right. So you're into Kiss, and you're still into Kiss. I just saw the post when you were in Los Angeles. You dressed up as Vinnie Vincent, though, right?
Oh yeah, that's in my book. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Vinnie Vincent. Let's talk about kind of your gravitation towards Vinnie. Why Vinnie?
Well, just because Vinnie represents, even now more than ever before, Vinnie represents what could have been. You know, with Tommy, no disrespect to Tommy and Eric, but I'm of the belief that new members, new makeup. And that's what Vinnie represented. That's what Eric Carr represented. And that's what I'd like to have seen that with, you know, the new members and the continual touring. That would have been great to me. Because mm-hmm. for me, Kiss are a fantasy. Kiss are they're from my childhood. And, you know, I just love to see the world expand, not just be limited to these four makeup designs. Mm-hmm. That's probably why I like Vinny, and I put on the makeup. I put on Vinny's makeup before anyone else's, just because he's such an outsider to that whole world. Mm-hmm. And you know, is of course his songwriting and his contribution stands on its own.
Now, going beyond Kiss, you're also a big fan of the Misfits, I understand. What was the connection? What led you to that next step?
Right, like basically rock to punk. Yeah. It was a very natural one. I got into rock, then I got into thrash metal, and thrash metal interviews in rock mags, they always, you know, cited punk bands, and so you start looking for those bands. I found the Misfits through Metallica t-shirts, and Minor Threat through, you know, tape trading with friends, and 7 Seconds and Youth of Today and Black Flag. And eventually it led me to the Bad Brains, mm-hmm. a metal magazine did actually, when they released Eye Against Eye. And I saw photos of these Rastafarian guys. And then I went to a record store in Toronto. I didn't find Eye Against Eye, I found Rock for Light. I turned on the other side, and it was an album produced by the guy in the Cars and all these Rastafarian guys. And then I brought the record home, and then I realized, wow, it really changed the way I saw music. I heard music, because they would go from like a song like Coptic Times to Rally Round Your Throne, a reggae song. I didn't understand it. It took me a while to really get into it. Mm-hmm. I love the fast stuff like Riot Squad, but then they'd break into some reggae song that it just kind of, I didn't understand. I didn't like it. And the more I heard it, the more I loved it. And that's when I realized, oh, music is, there's no boundaries. And at the time, there were some very dividing lines in music. And so in my head, I just said, I'm just going to like anything that sounds good to my ears. And that meant rap music. That meant, you know, noise rock. That meant heavy metal, whatever. Mm-hmm. Whatever sounded good to my ears. And so the Misfits, you know, of course, they're so melodic, and Glenn Danzig sang so beautifully. Who could not be a fan? And that continues to this day. I mean, I think last year, 2 years ago, we did a tour where our encore was nothing but Misfits covers.
Oh, that would be amazing. You didn't by chance tape any of those, did you?
They're online. Some people have, on YouTube. We did American Nightmare and... I can't remember off the top of my head, but yeah, we would do Hollywood Babylon and we in the past as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that'd be, I could totally see that fit, because listening to Danko Jones, the band really reminds me of a foundation of AC/DC, no ballads, straight up rockers. I think they call it pub rock in Australia, but AC/DC, Rose Tattoo, a more modern example is probably Jet and a few others. Is that a comparison you welcome?
Absolutely. Definitely. I great association with all the bands that you mentioned. I mean, of course, Rose Tattoo, AC/DC. Absolutely. Pub rock is, I don't know how it's taken in Australia. I know that other countries have their terms for it. In Canada, we don't have a term for it, but I understand it. I also think it comes with a tongue in cheek, and rock is seen as somewhat lowbrow, and that's fine. I don't mind. I don't care. But in Canada, we're almost treated as such, and that sometimes irks me. So I know what we play, and we're always going to be a hard rock band, and I love all that music. But I would like to see, rock treated a little better in some places. Mm. And that's more of a criticism about Canada than anywhere else.
So you find it's a bit of a, you're uniquely, I don't know if this is the right word, slagged on a bit in Canada unnecessarily, that it's a response you don't get elsewhere?
If we get it elsewhere, it's in another language and it's not brought to my attention.
Yeah, it's only behind your back at that point. Exactly. Why do you think that is? Because look, in the past several years, rock has really struggled, and it's kept its core following, but it also gets almost a comical persona. And so,
yes,
why do you think that is?
I just think over the years, there's been people who have co-opted it and made it a joke. It's a clown show at this point. You know, Beavis and Butthead, Wayne's World, Anvil movie, just the whole, rock and roll is often said in pop culture, but it's not even referencing the music. It's just a way to say party. Let's party. Let's rock and roll, or rock and roll meaning cool. And it has nothing to do with the music. And when the way I listen to music, the way I consume it, it's a very deep, very vast genre of music. It's decades old. There's tons of bands to mine. It's got such a rich history. There's so many discographies that you can get lost in. And yet, it's seen as this shallow kind of music. And you're right. It's not very popular anymore. But it is viewed as popular still because of the term rock and roll. It's still on everybody's lips when talking in just, the vernacular of just, speak. Just, informal speak. Everybody uses the term rock and roll when they're talking to their friends. But the reality is... it's an underground form of music now, and I am banging with my gavel for everyone to hear this, because growing up, the coolest kind of music was always underground. I mean, I always loved, it's called alternative music, but noise rock and all kinds of underground bands, that's got a cachet of cool, and rock and roll doesn't have that cool, brand, and yet it is underground, and it should be recognized as such. It's gone the way of jazz. EDM, pop music, even heavy metal is more popular than rock and roll. Fine. I'm fine with that. Let it be. It's cool to be into rock and roll. I like the underground distinction of rock and roll. Being underground, I like it. I like to look at it and listen to it like that. Mm-hmm. And we want to play in front of thousands of people. Sometimes we do, but it's just not on the world stage as other forms of music are. When you see the Grammys, it's so obvious.
Right. But I mean, that's very much a popularity and what's in the social conscience at that moment. They tend to mine it for things like the Grammys. To me, that's a bit of an outlier. But what do you think would be an event or a trend that would help bring rock and roll, good rock and roll, back to the forefront?
Yeah, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know if it would be a a distinct event, like a real specific event, or it's just this slow building way of listening to rock and roll in a new way. I really don't know. If I knew, we would be quietly doing it. But I don't know.
I think one of the things that kind of strikes me is the innovation of rock and roll has been pretty stagnant for some time. There hasn't been, and rock and roll lends itself to more acoustic, more organic instruments. Whereas if you go to something like rap or EDM or whatever, you could actually play with a much wider tonal vocabulary because they accept things like, for like it or not, auto-tune and all sorts of electronics that actually put new sounds out there. Where with rock and roll, it seems like you're kind of working. To me, rock and roll is like Mexican food. It's the same ingredients folded in different ways.
Yeah, you comparing rock and roll to Mexican food is bang on. I love Mexican food.
Me too.
And
believe me, I'll take a burrito over just about any fine cuisine too.
And you can have a burrito 3 times a day. And I did on this last American tour. So yes, you're right. I guess it's not a very open type of music, and that turns off a lot of people, especially like you're saying with all these new sounds hitting our ears these days. Yeah, it does remind a lot of, especially younger people, of what their uncle listens to, not what they listen to. And every generation needs to have their own form of music. But rock and roll is, I have a different view of it. It embodies freedom to me. Mm-hmm. It beyond the music, it means freedom, and freedom to do and say, what you want to do and say and be. We don't subscribe to the rock and roll look. We don't have tattoos. I don't have long hair. I don't have a handlebar mustache. We don't wear jeans on stage or whatever. We don't do those, a lot of rock and roll things. And I feel that's okay, because in the world of rock and roll, it's accepted because of the freedom that it's supposed to embody. That's why when people get on us saying, oh, you guys don't do this and you don't do that, well, we don't follow a rule book. But you are right. There is a very distinct sound and instrumentation that rock and roll has, I don't know if it'll take a rock band with electronic beats to break through. I don't know. I don't have the answer to that.
And that was just an observation I have, because I've got younger kids, and when I listen to the music that they're listening to, not that I like much of it really, or I'd listen to it on my own, but some of it is like, wow, that's a really interesting timbre there. And it reminds me of back in the day when I'd hear someone like early Metallica album, Lars Ulrich on the double bass, going like, holy shit, how did he do that? Or you'd hear a guitar tone that comes out of big crunch Anthrax, riffs, and it's like, holy shit, how did he make that sound? Now it seems to be, I don't know if we've exhausted that level of surprise with those instruments, but that's what it kind of feels like. I haven't had that, that holy shit moment just sonically with rock for some time.
You're right.
I don't know if I'm right. It's just an observation. I went to go see Eminem with my son last week, and that was one of the things that I thought was more interesting than just about any show, anything that was going on the stage, is just the audio and the way it was being represented.
Well, the Kamikaze Eminem album did have me reacting the way you just described. I was like, how did he do that?
It's amazing.
It's an amazing album. But I still think, and I still believe, in the magic of a simple rock riff, well-written rock riff. I still believe in the magic of that. I still believe it can move somebody. It can still turn my head when I hear a band come up with a riff, a rock riff, and I go, whoa, that's good. Mm-hmm. And there's still bands that really do that for me that are new and that are out there, like Admiral Sir Cloudesley Shovel and Judah, mm-hmm. two bands that come to mind very quickly. and that we've toured with. We've taken them out on tour, and I'm a huge fan of, you know. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the Danko Jones records. Now, you've got quite a few rare records in the discography of Danko Jones, yeah?
Are you talking about my personal collection?
No. Or the band, oh. Like, for instance, Girl Gun. Apparently, only 10 copies of that record exist. Is that correct?
We never printed them up. Originally, that was an EP that was put out by the guy who did our website long, long time ago. Mm-hmm. And then there was someone in Germany who basically printed up a few copies, and I think he's registered it on Discogs. And I think I have a copy of it. I have one of the 10 copies. I guess they're unofficially bootlegs, but and we're fine with that as long as it's something that, you know, we're not currently promoting or have, you know, in our thing. If it's a live thing, I'm all for bootlegs of our live shows on vinyl and stuff. I love that kind of stuff. But yeah, there's actually someone who makes his own vinyl and then puts it in limited copies. He gives us a few, but he doesn't print up enough to, you know, sell and make a profit out of. It's just strictly for
the love of
being
it.
Being a fan of the band, and that's cool with me. Like, I get that. I get it.
Would you ever consider giving him a few outtakes or something unique to put on some of these rare records?
Perhaps, but he will find it himself. Oh. he's that fanatical about it, and that's, I mean, he surprised us. I can't believe it. So I'm actually, if I was to give him a track, then I would know what's coming. I want to be surprised.
Now, going back into your catalog a little bit, Born a Lion, that vinyl seems to be quite desired these days, yeah? Do you remember how many were printed originally? I think there was a few colored versions. There was an orange one. There may have been a white one. Do you remember any of the quantities?
I do not. I sign a bunch when we're on tour all the time, and we still sell it on vinyl. We still have copies of it on sale when we tour. Mm-hmm. I think we have every single release we've ever put out. Every studio album we've ever put out has been released on vinyl from day one. We've never had to go back and release it on vinyl due to the vinyl popularity. Mm. It's always been out on vinyl. And that's something that I've never even thought about. I've just assumed it's coming out on vinyl since we've been putting out studio albums. So that's, yeah, I know that a lot of bands these days play catch up to, you know, their CDs they put out, but we've always put it out on vinyl. I'm a vinyl maniac. So I've just never had to chase it. You know, it's always been there ready for me to put in my collection of my own stuff.
Yeah. So for you, a record really isn't done until you have a physical vinyl copy in your hand.
No, it's not. I have a vinyl copy of everything we've ever put out. I know not every band can say that, even successful ones. Mm-hmm. So that's satisfying in a way that there's always been room for vinyl.
Do you still have all the master tapes? Do you know where everything is? So if you have to do repressings or anything like that, you're able to do that?
I personally don't, but JC would know. He's in charge of all that stuff. He knows where it is. And we can do that at a drop of a dime.
Tell me the story about being dropped from Universal Canada. Apparently, it had something to do, or you suspect it had something to do, with you coming out and being a proponent of downloading music. Yeah?
I can only say suspect.
Okay.
And that is, it's an old story. Wow, you dug that one up. I don't get asked that very often. But yeah, true enough, we put out a record and we licensed our albums. A lot of people thought we had become a major label band and we're signed to Universal, but it was a licensing deal through Universal Canada where it allowed them to put out our album in Canada. We put it out and we did pretty good for Born a Lion. And then when it came time to put out the next album, they balked. And it probably they got really mad at an interview I did where I came out as a pro downloader. At the time, there was a lot of talk about Napster and people were talking about it. And it's not much of a talking point these days. But back then it was like, man, it was all that the music industry rested on. Mm-hmm. And I just said, hey, why am I going to come out against people who download our music? They're obviously fans of our band, and I don't want to be put in a position where we're against the people who like our music. And so I think that irked a lot of people at the label. There was a very nasty message that was on my answering machine from someone there. A couple of months, I can't remember exactly the timeline, we were dropped. However, what gets forgotten in this whole thing is that the Canadian version of our CD, We Sweat Blood, there were so many misprints on the actual CD jacket. It just showed how much they really didn't care about whether or not they put out a proper version of our album or not. So in the end we parted, and it was good to part. But there's a lot of fallout from that parting. I don't think I'm at liberty to talk about. I wish I could, because it would, prove a lot of the points I have about the music industry. But anyways, it's water under the bridge. We're very happy, where we are. Funny thing is, we went only onwards and upwards after that. It didn't hamper our band at all. So at the time, I was a little worried, like, what's going to happen? But mm-hmm. Nothing really did happen. We don't get talked about too much, but that's okay. We still play. We still got people who come out to our shows, and we're able to tour the world in a way that some of their direct signings were not able to.
So, yeah, it seems to be that of the artists that I talk to on the show, the ones that are aligned to major labels, if they are truly kind of like the upper 1%, in terms of musical success, it's tended to have worked quite well for them, but I think that's a numbers thing anyway. Most of the artists that manage their own releases and use record labels more for distribution than anything seem to be the happiest.
Absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Because they have the most freedom. And if you give up that freedom for monetary reasons, you're giving up a bigger slice of your pie than you think. I've just seen how bands have been treated and sidelined over the years, and really good bands, that the world won't hear. And those guys put everything into it, and now they gotta, find some other means of work. And mm-hmm. I'm a band guy, yeah. I'm pro band.
So for instance, for Rock Supreme, there was no one else in the decision making of the songs or the content or anything, just you, JC, and Rich. That was it.
Yes, absolutely. It's the three of us. And sometimes, because it is a democracy, because we go through it, it takes longer than if there was just one person making the decisions. We all kind of give our 2 cents, 3 cents. Sometimes it's even a nickel. And we bang out a decision. There's people, in our management and, people at several of the labels that we work with who, give their 2 cents, and we take it in, and final decision is ours.
The new album was produced by Garth Richardson, who's got an amazing resume. He's one of these guys that, kind of goes under the radar, but he's done some amazing stuff. Chili Peppers, Biffy Clyro, Rage, the debut of Rage Against the Machine. What is Garth's technique for production?
Well, what I learned with Garth is, he's got so much experience, he can just listen to a track and know what to do. But what a really good producer like Garth does is he knows when to let it go, and he knows when to really stick his head in. And he didn't stick his head in too much to the songs when we were in pre-production, because we really bring the songs to a point where the song is done. But I will say that, in the beginning, we worked on a song called Fists Up High off the album, and he really had some immediate arrangement changes. And Fists Up High is one of my favorite songs on the album. And it was going into pre-production, I was very wary of what he had to offer because it was a precious song to me. And sure enough, man, he sliced and diced it, kind of put this part over here, put this part over there. And sure enough, it became a better song. And when I heard that, when I saw that right in front of my face, I go, okay, now I understand who we're working with here. He knows what he's talking about. And I also observed how he didn't, you know, when he knew when to let go of something that, you know, was his idea, or if we didn't go with it, he would let go, and he wasn't pushy that way. But he also knew how to get tones, you know, instantly almost, what was a good guitar tone. And that's just experience. And he knew when a song just wasn't there yet. And I'm talking pre-production. He just knew it wasn't hitting right. And he would make some suggestions. I think a producer who really knows, you know, and very confident with their production skill doesn't bang on a band's head and stomps on a band. Just you know, gives this quiet suggestion and then leans back. And that was Garth to us. And we laughed through the whole session. We joked around through the whole session, and that lent itself to a really productive environment. Everybody was able to relax. There was harmony in the studio, and it was great. I had a great time with Garth. And add to that is we found out quickly that Garth and I grew up in the same neighborhood, in the same suburb of Toronto, 10 minutes away from each other. The house he grew up in was 10 minutes from the apartment I grew up in, and the school, the grade school he went to, I would look out of my bedroom window to its playground. So I probably saw Garth when I was a toddler playing in the playground or something. I don't know, playing football or something. It was weird how close we grew up together.
You guys had like maybe some of the same contacts, been to the same shows, that sort of thing.
Not the same shows, but we knew the same buildings. Like he knew Peanut Plaza. And I had no idea the guy who produced Rage Against the Machine hung out at Peanut Plaza.
So Garth gets involved in the songwriting portion. You guys collect all the different demos, share with him what it is you're looking at, and he helps you sort it from there. How much involvement does he have before you guys go into the recording studio?
We bring the songs to a point where it is a song from beginning to end. We don't bring in parts and try and write it on the spot in the studio. So he listens to the demos of our songs and he gives his two cents. Like, I really like these songs and I'm not really a fan of this. There are sometimes if one of us really likes a song, we'll make an argument for it. But we give him songs that we're ready to record and that we like. So if he doesn't like this song, but he likes that song, fair enough. We like it too. So let's go in and record these songs. There was a song that he didn't like so much that I liked, but he liked all these other songs. So, you know, whatever. We'll get to that song another time or not. It happens. There's always songs that hit the cutting room floor, and you can't be precious with the songs, you know, before the album is done. You just got to pick the best songs and that's what he does. And then when we're in the studio, in pre-production with our instruments in hand and he's producing us, and the songwriting that he contributes is more of an arrangement at that point. He'll say something like, oh, this song needs an ending. That happened once on this new album. And so we just looked at each other, and luckily enough, we were able to come up with an ending right on the spot. That was lucky. But most of the time, the songs are done. Like, the parts are done, and maybe the arrangement needs a little bit of tweaking, and that's where Garth will come in. But for the most part, the songwriting happens before pre-production. But yeah, he definitely helped in arrangement.
Now, I've noticed at DankoJones.com there's all sorts of vinyl variants and different versions of a Rock Supreme. Do you get involved in the color variants? Do you get involved in the packaging of this, or is that kind of a management distributor thing?
Well, as much as a vinyl fiend that I am, I do not get too involved in the different color schemes of the vinyl. Like the last album, the last two albums definitely had multiple colors. And you can get it on purple, orange, you know, red. I'm not really involved in that. And the main reason why I don't stick my head in that is because I like my albums black. I got to be honest with you. And I do know that some collectors, they like different colors. And so because I don't personally, sure, the colors are great. But me personally, I just like it black. And a colored vinyl has never really appealed to me as a consumer of vinyl. I just like it black. And but if you like it in purple, and I must say the Wildcat version of purple version on vinyl is amazing. Looks amazing. But and I do have a copy of that, but black is what I prefer.
Okay. All right. Any particular reason, or it's just your preference, your own madness, just making that choice?
My own madness, but also it's just, that's how records came since I was a kid and I got Jungle Book on 45, it was black. And so that's how I've always seen vinyl.
So Jungle Book and Kiss, that was the beginning of Danko Jones.
The Bare Necessities. Mm-hmm. And Do You Love Me?
So tell me about your record collection.
To be honest with you, it's grown and then shrunk and then grown again, shrunk, and it's in a phase where it's growing. I have gone through phases over the years where, due to, you know, space constraints, I've had to let go a lot of my vinyl. Due to me needing money, I've had to sell off vinyl, and for various reasons. Those two reasons mainly, my collection has changed over the years. There's tons of vinyl, tons of records that I can say, I used to have a copy of that, or I've had to buy a copy again because I sold it and I want it again. Or I think I sold it and now I have two copies of it. So that's how it is. And currently right now it just takes up a Billy bookcase or a IKEA 5x5 and then another IKEA 2x4 of records. But that's about it. It's a small collection. I think
that's
you
a
know,
pretty sizable collection. To fill an IKEA Kallax bookcase is quite an investment there.
Yeah, I used to have a 4x4, and then it got to be a 5x5, and then I had an extra thing, and then I had crates with the 5x5, and it just changes. The collection always changes, but right now, I've leveled off. I was in a phase where I was just buying vinyl like a madman, but now you're talking to me as it's kind of leveling off. But it'll come back again. The hunger always comes back, and I hit record shows when it does come.
What are some of the records in your collection that you're most proud of? If there was a fire in your house and you had to grab, you know, a handful of records, what would be in there?
Probably Cookie Puss by the Beastie Boys. Signed copies of albums, like my Motorhead signed copy, Motley Crue's Too Fast for Love signed by all the band members. And then some of my kitschy kind of records are probably my most valuable, like my Don Knotts record. I'm a huge Three's Company fan. Yeah, stuff like that. It's not really what I think a lot of people would think.
A Don Knotts record. Okay. What is that, like a Don Knotts comedy?
Yes, oh, an evening okay. with, yeah.
He was, and, he wasn't Mr. Furley. He wasn't the character of Mr. Furley in there. It's just he was regular.
No, he was Barney that album came out. But there's a lot of, like, I call them next level kind of kitschy records. Those are probably what I put the most value on, other than, like, signed copies of records I have. Just yeah, that those would be it. Reverse Willie Horton by The Blues Explosion's another one.
Oh, okay. Do you care if things are first pressing or not? Does it matter to you?
No, I don't. Although I've caught myself going, this is like a third pressing. I'm not interested. So I say it, but then again, I love first pressings just because that you could get it on, you can stream the album. And the reason for getting a vinyl copy is to get a little piece of history, I think, at this point. So, first pressings sometimes matter. But then again, you know, try buying Blue Note or Impulse first pressings and it scares the hell out of you. So I, when it comes to like Impulse, I'll take a third pressing.
Yeah, I'm attracted to pick up a record because it was made at the time the artist was still alive, like a Jimi Hendrix record. For some reason, I find a value in saying, wow, this was something that was on Earth at the same time its creator was. But even though those first pressings sound horrible.
Yes, but that's a dangerous way to view things because that's very appealing to me. Mm. And that would make me throw down some cash, and I shouldn't do that. But the way you just described why you should buy first pressings, that's a good reason.
Yeah. Well, no, that's just it's my own madness that's driving me to do that. It's my own justification. When I see it, it's like, oh, I could do that. Oh, you know what's the connection? It's me trying to sell myself on the concept of taking that record home with me.
And you sold me on it.
Oh no, it's like
a great
virus.
Way to view it. Yes, it's a great way to view it. I love that. I love thinking like that. It's the reason why you get autographs. Like for example, now that Lemmy's passed, my autographed Motorhead album is so valuable. Mm-hmm. And it's valuable because in the short period of time Lemmy was alive on this earth, there was a few seconds he took out of his, you know, short life to sign my album. Mm-hmm. That's how I view autographed albums.
Yeah. Well, you've got a lot of special memories of Lemmy as well. I mean, you shared the stage with him at some point. Yeah.
Yeah. I sung Killed by Death over a dozen times and less than 20 times. It's somewhere in there. And the last time I sang with Motorhead was on stage in Toronto when we weren't even on the bill. And I was just like guesting because I'd done it already so many times. They just brought me on because I was in the crowd. And that was very special to me. Mm. And Lemmy was always very nice to us and very good to our band.
I've got a short Lemmy story. I was in Los Angeles drinking, as you do, and Lemmy was at the bar. And we ended up kind of socializing and kind of shooting the shit, whatever. My girlfriend comes up to me a little bit later in the evening, my girlfriend at the time, I should say, and she says, "Your friend just tried to pick up on me." And I said, which friend are you talking about? And she's, "Him, that guy." She pointed to Lemmy. I'm like, "That's fucking Lemmy. You do what Lemmy says." You do it. Anyway, tell us about the Johnny Cash story. This, again, and it, by the way, we haven't even talked about your book yet. I know we've got limited time here, but Danko, you wrote this book, I've Got Something to Say. It's packed full of great stories. It's one of these things that I just pick up, I read a couple chapters, a couple of pages here and there, and it's a great mood lifter. One of the stories you told in there was about Johnny Cash. Can you quickly walk us through that one?
Yeah, absolutely. That happened somewhere in the early to mid 90s. I was working in a record store called Music World in Toronto, and it was the same chain of record stores that my mom took me to buy my first Kiss album.
Kiss Alive, yeah.
Yeah, Kiss Alive. So, the Highwaymen were in town. And so that's why when two figures who look like June Carter and Johnny Cash walked by the store, I knew it was them. You know, I didn't go, "Ha ha, that guy looks like Johnny Cash." I knew he was in town. I ran out of the store, and my manager at the time thought I was chasing after some sort of shoplifter. And I come back in the store with Johnny Cash walking behind me. Now, I ran up to Johnny Cash, and I said, "Oh my God, Mr. Cash, I'm a huge fan." I started to list off these records I had, like Live at Folsom Prison. I have it. And so he looked at me like this kind of Lollapalooza alternative weirdo guy. And June Carter gave me a smile, like a very motherly smile. And she said, "Okay, I'll go here." So she went across the hall of the shopping mall to another store called the Nature Company. And that chain of stores has gone under since. Mm-hmm. But Johnny Cash...
She essentially removed herself so you two could spend time together.
Yeah, I realized it afterwards that it was June Carter, but like my mind was only focused on Johnny Cash, man. So she was really nice about it. And he just goes, "You work here?" And, you know, there's a big sign that says Music World. And I go, "Yeah, well, I have to do this song with this band called Nirvana for a Willie Nelson tribute album." And Kurt Cobain had already passed away. And I said, okay. So I brought him in. And in the front of the store was the top 30 CDs that were bestsellers. And at the time, Nirvana's Unplugged was charting. And so that was the album that was, you know, closest to my hand that I just took the nearest one I could find. I wanted to give him Bleach, but you know, that would have meant me going to the to the Nirvana bin. And I didn't know how long I had Johnny Cash for, so I just took the Unplugged album off the shelf, gave it to him, and he bought it. And sure enough, months later, he appeared on a Willie Nelson tribute album with Chris Novoselic and Dave Grohl. And I'd like to think he walked into that session knowing who they were because of me. And he signed, you know, like just pieces of paper we could find. He signed his name on it. And then we later compared it to the autograph that was on one of his Johnny Cash CDs we had in the store. Sure enough, it was. And that's my Johnny Cash story. And I forgot about the story I had until the Highwaymen were playing on the Grammys like a few years ago. And I was watching it with someone. And I said, you know, Johnny Cash is supposed to be in this. I met Johnny Cash, and then I retold that story to them, and I was writing for the Huffington Post at the time, and that became my next article. And then Valiant himself, from the band Valiant Thor, illustrated that story for my book, I've Got Something to Say.
Yeah. For people who haven't seen the book, there's little vignettes throughout the book. There's chapters, there's reading words, and then there's looking pages, you like comic books, and that's one of the comics. That's a perfect story. The only thing that would have made it better is if you did find a copy of Bleach, and then smash cut to about 6 months later, you get a cover of Johnny singing "Daddy's Little Girl Ain't a Girl No More."
That would have been amazing. That would have floored me. But I would have. But when I gave him Unplugged, the first thing that came to my mind is this dude should have Bleach, but. Because it was Unplugged and acoustic, it's, you know, it could kind of, you know, hit his ears in a way that might, you know, might lend itself quicker to than just Bleach.
It was for him, not you. So, yeah, fair enough.
yeah, exactly.
Danko, this is fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide. We really appreciate you taking the time. Love to invite you back at any point. I want to remind everyone, A Rock Supreme by Danko Jones is out April 26th. However, you can pre-order now at dankojones.com. You go through, there's an assortment of various colors of pressings and that sort of stuff. Or you could just get regular black like Danko and the rest of the world tend to like it as well. There's a 7-inch out there of Dance, Dance, Dance. But I also encourage folks to pick up a copy of Danko's book, I've Got Something to Say. It is hilarious. You could buy it off Amazon, but I'd encourage you to try to find it from a record shop or, you know, an independent bookstore. Or better yet, go see Danko Jones live. They're at the merch booth, and you could even get the man to scrawl his name on it. Danko, thank you so much for joining us here again.
Thanks a lot, Nate. It's been a pleasure, and I love The Vinyl Guide. I love being on it.
And The Vinyl Guide loves you.
Let's go. you moving the feet. If you turn it up a little bit higher, gonna lose it and I'll start to perspire. I don't mind cause I'm along for the ride. I don't mind cause I'm along for the ride. I like to see her moving up and alive. I get off watching her gets me high. I don't mind cause I'm along for the ride. I don't mind cause I'm along for the ride. I like to watch her move her hips to the side. Watching her gets me high. Dance, dance, dance. I love to watch her move that body. Dance, dance, dance. I can watch it every day.
Dance, Dance, Dance from the upcoming Danko Jones LP, A Rock Supreme, which you could pre-order at dankojones.com. Lots of colored vinyl variants up there, so look around, pick one that you like, and make sure you lock it in before they sell out. That's dankojones.com. Alrighty, well, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. You know, if you're on Instagram, make sure you follow us at Vinyl Guide. Over the past few weeks, I've been doing a lot of live videos up there. I just launch Instagram. It's so easy. I just start an Instagram live stream, and I go through my record cabinet. I take different questions. I pull out records and discuss the different variations, that sort of stuff. It's a bit of ad hoc fun. What do you know? So anyway, Instagram.com/Vinyl Guide. Follow us up there. And of course, if you love this show and would like to do something nice for your buddy Nate, head over to patreon.com/vinylguide. Give us a bit of a sponsorship. That would be much appreciated. And there's also a bunch of exclusive content up there as well. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.